I'm going to start with a question, and it's going to be kind of a rhetorical question, but I'm going to need some answers. So think about it as I start this story. What would you do if you heard that somebody won the Super Lotto or something, you know, and it was like $500 million, and you think, man, that was a lucky person. And then a couple days later, a friend calls you and says, that was me. And before I go to the to tell the state that it was me, it's more money than I could ever use. So what I'm going to do is gather several of my friends, you being one of them, and we're going to divide this up and say we bought the ticket together. Okay? And you think, good friend, you know, and that would be a great idea. And he's going to share the lottery with you. What would be the first thing you would buy? What would, you know, all of a sudden, I mean, am I the only one that's ever thought about winning the lottery and thinking, well, you know, I'd pay off my house, or we'd get the plumbing fixed, or, you know, add on to the house, or what would the kids buy? You got to think of something. A Viper would be cool, you know. That would be, we'd collect a lot of attention if we drove up here in a Viper, you know. Would it change your life? It would change your life a lot, wouldn't it? It would change your life a lot. Your life would never be the same. And when you hear about people winning the lottery, sometimes it's not good. You know, all that money, all of a sudden, you think you're going to do really great things with it. You know, well, we'd buy First Baptist Church, and we could do all kinds of, or buy a piece of property. But it would definitely change your life, wouldn't it? And he would be a pretty good friend. Well, several months go by, and you're getting used to the money, and everything is fine, and your life has changed. And all of a sudden, this friend calls you up, and he says to you, you know, I've got a problem, and I need some help. Would you mind coming over for a couple days and just giving me a hand around my house? What would you say? What would you say? Sure, no problem. You know, it would be reasonable to think, man, this guy changed my life. I could come over to his house for a few days and give him some of my time, right? It would be reasonable. It would be an okay thing for him to ask of you, you know. He could probably say to you, get over here, right? And he could say that. He would say, I need help, and you need to be here now. And you would go. What we're going to begin to look at in Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, is kind of that scenario. Paul begins to move from the first 11 chapters of the book of Romans, explaining all the things that God has done for us, all of the things that he has given us, and how he has changed us, and how our lives are now changed. And then in Romans chapter 12, I was going to do the whole chapter, but there's so much stuff in here, I couldn't do that. Romans chapter 12, just turn there, and many of you probably have these verses memorized, and they're very familiar, I am sure. But think about what God is saying to us here. It is that same scenario. He's looking down, or Paul is coming to us, and he says, I urge you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. Paul could have said here, get over here now. He could say, now it's time to buck up and be a man. It's time now to give your life. Think about what God has done. But instead he says, I urge you. What does the old King James say? I beseech. I mean, it's kind of a, it's probably what we memorized it in. I've never heard anybody say that in my life. Oh, I beseech you to come over. I mean, nobody ever says that anymore. But the New American Standard says, I urge you. What does the NIV say? I urge you. Think about how good God has been to us. And now he says, I urge you to do something. I beg you to do something. And if you think back of this story of somebody that gave you the lottery money, you would probably, when you put it in terms of just this life, that would be reasonable. You wouldn't even think twice about going over to his house and helping him. That's the way Paul wants us to think about how we now act in light of what God has already done. And what he's going to do in chapters 12, 13, all the way through 16, is now give us ways that we are to act in light of what God has already done. And when he says, I urge you, brethren, therefore, or I urge you, therefore, brethren, and really in the Greek, the first word is urge. Whenever they wanted to emphasize something in Greek, apparently, the sentences in Greek are kind of weird. They weren't like subject, verb, predicate, or whatever they're called. They could put the words anywhere in the sentence. And so when they wanted to emphasize something, they put it right at the start. So the first thing Paul says is, I urge you to do this. In light of all that I have said, I beg you. This is what I want you to do. And in light of what? In the light of the mercies of God. And I just listed some of the things. In Romans chapter 3, verse 24, we are justified as a gift by his grace. Chapter 5, verse 1, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Chapter 5, verse 9, we are saved from wrath. I mean, when you begin to think of all the stuff that we've just gone through in the first 11 chapters of Romans, in chapter 6, verse 6, he says our old self was crucified with him. Similar to what, if you won the lottery, how that would change your life, think of how spiritually God has changed our life. When we put our trust in what Christ did for us at the cross, we are now totally new creations. Our old self was crucified with him. Chapter 6, verse 11, we have died to sin, but we have been made alive to God. Our entire spiritual life has been started. We were dead. We had no relationship with God. And he came down and sent his son and bridged the gap between us and him. In chapter 6, verse 13, Paul mentions, this isn't the first time he says to present ourselves. In chapter 6, verse 13, he says, And do not go on presenting the members of your body to sin as instruments of unrighteousness, but present yourselves to God as those alive from the dead, and your members as instruments of righteousness to God. And now he's saying, guys, I beg you to do this. I beg you to do this. Verse 14 in chapter 6. We're not under the law anymore. We're under grace. All of the stuff that Paul has to explain to us now to get us to begin to rethink this whole relationship between us and God. Because what Paul has explained in the book of Romans isn't how man normally thinks. You know, if your friend did win the lottery, it would be normal for him if he gave you half of it. It would be normal for him to say, get over here. That would be the normal way. But now, Paul is saying, think about how good God is. And in light of what he has done for you, in light of that, I beg you to present your body a living sacrifice. Then in verse 8 he says, or chapter 8 he says, there's no separation. At the end of chapter 8 he says, there's no condemnation. We will never stand before God condemned. Ever. Ever. In light of that, Paul says, in light of all these truths, our motivation, that ought to motivate us to live different. I tell you, before I got saved, it was really kind of a guilt trip. You know, religions can use guilt. I mean, it kind of works. You know, if you really want to get God on your side, you got to live this way. What Paul is saying here is, since God is on your side, since God already loves you, this is how you ought to live. It's a totally different order of motivation. You know, and our natural minds don't think like this. You know, I mean, and unfortunately we sometimes do this when we raise our kids. You know, I told you you need to do, you know, get your act together. And all of a sudden when we come to the gospel, it's like, it's a new motivation. It's what God has already done for us. By the mercies of God, Paul says, I want you to present your bodies a living sacrifice. This one commentary I read said, we're not any longer driven by duty, but we're drawn by God's grace. There is a whole different motivation. God isn't saying to us, driving us to live different. You know, this now is your duty. If your friend called you up, he could say to you after he gave you the lottery, you owe this to me. What do you mean you don't have time? And he could use guilt and duty and say, you need to come over here. When God says, come on over. Think of the difference. When that friend calls you up and says, can you come on over? Man, you'd want to. You know, especially if he asked you that way. You're like, well, yeah. And that's what God is, and that's how Paul is presenting this to us. He's saying, I'm not driving you by the duty that you owe God now. I'm drawing you by God's grace and his mercies. And that word is plural. It's not just God's mercy. And if you remember at the end of chapter 11, he says in verse 30, for just as you were once disobedient to God, but now have been shown mercies because of their disobedience, the Jews, so these also now who have been disobedient, in order that because of the mercy shown to you may also now be shown mercy. For God has shut up all in disobedience that he might show mercy to all. It's a whole different motivation. We're not driven by duty. Actually, one of the commentaries I read, and I scratched out the title of this chapter, it said, the Christian duty. And I'm like, I know it's kind of sounds right, but it's really Paul saying and God saying, no, come think about what I've done for you. And now present your body a living sacrifice. That word offer, present, it means to put at God's disposal. Isn't that a fair thing for God to ask? You know, put your life at his disposal. It doesn't mean we got to be, and for the kids, it doesn't mean you got to be dorky. It doesn't mean you got to be, you know, odd. It doesn't mean you have to be, you know, what it means is you get a chance to put to live for the God that loves you more than you could ever ask or think. Think of all the songs we just sang this morning. I mean, it's unbelievable how they all fit. And Paul is saying to us, think about this and be drawn to living a life by his grace, not out of duty, not because you have to, because you want to. Well, more, because you get to. I mean, you get to do this. And think, you know, nobody, well, not nobody. The word sacrifice, I mean, when Paul wrote that, and he says, present your body a living sacrifice, that was kind of odd. Because what is it? What do you do with a sacrifice? I mean, in those days, what did they do with a sacrifice? Killed it. They slit its throat, and it was bloody, and it, you know, and both, not only the Jews did that, but the Romans had their own sacrifices. I don't know if you remember the movie The Gladiator, where they had little icons and they would sacrifice to these icons, and it was kind of the whole mindset in that world when he said that was there was no such thing as a living sacrifice. They were dead. You know, the point of a sacrifice was you killed it. And you know, what Paul is saying, and what I think that when we look back at what he said in this whole book, you know, this might cost you something. Living the Christian life, you know, we live in a world now in the United States, you know, sometimes you might be made fun of. You know, that might be the worst thing that would happen to you. You know, there's countries where if you get saved, and apparently there's a lot of people getting saved in Muslim countries. Did you know that? I mean, there's like revivals happening in Iraq and Iran, which you don't hear about in the news. Well, those people, I mean, when you get saved there, that's trouble. You know, I mean, that is trouble. You can get killed for that. I mean, you could be a living sacrifice for a short period of time. You know, I mean, it could be killed for your faith. Here, I mean, the living, you know, it's really pretty easy. We have it pretty easy. But what this one commentator talked about, when you think about giving up your life, you know, giving your body as a living sacrifice. And it's not so much thinking about how much it's going to cost you. But he gave an illustration of, you know, if I gave Diane a Valentine's present, and I kept saying to her, man, if you knew how much this cost, you know, how would she like that? Not very much. But if I said to her, I love you this much, the value of the sacrifice isn't how much it might cost you. It's how much you love the person you're sacrificing to. That's what this living sacrifice is. It, kids, it may cost you sometimes. You know, but I'll tell you, if you ask any adult in this room, he'll say or she'll say, it's worth it. The littlest, you know, the thing that I think I may have sacrificed the most is nothing. It's nothing compared to what I really owe him. And there's three things that Paul talks about this sacrifice. Number one, he says it's a living sacrifice. I mean, you get to live this life. It's not a burden. It's not. It, sometimes it may, you know, you may have to give some money or something, you know, and you might know what. Maybe you want to buy something. You think, well, the church kind of needs it. It might cost you something, but you get to do this. You get to live this life for a purpose. You know, half the world out there is living their life not knowing what they're doing. I was going to bring this up later, but I'm sure you've seen the news about, what's her name, Anna Nicole. Somebody said, when I first heard that she died, I thought they said that her daughter died, and I thought, oh man, that's going to be bad. But she died. And you think about what how the world is reacting to this. And what was my point? They think about what she was living for. It's a very, very sad. It made me sad. You know, I don't know. But when you, as believers, guess what we get to live for? Something way more valuable than a $1.6 billion estate. I mean, really, we get to live for something way more valuable. Now, would I turn down $1.6 million? Not, probably not. But I still get to live for something way more valuable. And we need to encourage each other that we are living for something way more valuable than that. He also says it's holy. When something was declared holy, it was set apart. It was God's property. When you are a living sacrifice, you are now set apart for God. You're at His disposal. He gets to use you. That's pretty cool. That's not a bad thing. To be used by God? You know, we're a living sacrifice, and it's a holy sacrifice. It's set apart for Him, for His purpose, for His use. And it's acceptable. That word, acceptable, it's used a couple times here. It's in verse 2, it's used again. But it's pleasing to Him. After all that God has done for us, and then we get to be a living sacrifice and please Him. I mean, this is, you know, this is not what man would set up as a religion. This has to be divine. This has to be how God would, you know, because it's so contrary to how man would react. You owe God this. When now God says, I urge you, be a living sacrifice. You can be set apart for me. And I am going to be pleased when you do it. And then he says at the end, which is your spiritual service of worship. And it's kind of odd how that's been translated in a bunch of different ways. It basically means it's the word we get, the Greek word is the one we get from the word logic. I mean, it says, basically, this is reasonable. This isn't, God isn't asking like too much from us. This is like reasonable. This is okay. And it's a worship to do this. And sometimes we think, because the way we have set up our week, I mean, we worship here, right? And we just did it for, I don't know, a half hour singing songs, and this is part of the worship. But it seems like what Paul is saying here is, you know what? Monday morning is worship. When I had to, I had to get up at, I don't know, 4 a.m. to go fly in a plane, and I have a tendency to complain about that, and think, oh man, poor me. You know what I ought to be thinking? I get to do this. Worship doesn't stop when we walk out of here. Worship is where you go to work, is where you go to school, how you react to your brothers and sisters, how you react to your boss. And you know what's funny is one of my trips this last week, I was scared. I was going in front of this lady that's a VP, and we're trying to design something for her, and I was pretty nervous. And I threw stuff together. I mean, we did some work on it, but it felt like it was thrown together. And I got there, and she loved it. And I wanted to go, are you sure? No. I mean, instead of just saying, thanks, God, because I had to pray a lot. I was praying thinking, uh-oh, and I'm telling you, there's times in your, sometimes you got to put yourself out there, guys and young people. Give stuff a try sometimes. You know, stretch yourself out there a little bit. When it's real scary, you gotta pray. When you're saying, you know, to God, say, man, I don't think I can do this, perfect. Perfect. Because then he can show you what he can do with the likes of us. So, you know, I'm telling you, the older I get, it seems like the less confidence I have. You know, when I was 16, I thought I could, you know, I played football, and I was like, they used to give us these jackets when I was in high school, and they were like four sizes too big for us to make you look like really big, you know, and we'd wear them to the dance, you know, and there was the Lane guys over here and the Schurz guys over here, and we all, and I mean, the point is, the more you try and put yourself out there and risk some things and say to God, okay, I'll try this. Watch him work. Present your body as a living sacrifice. It's living, it's holy, it's pleasing to him, and it's reasonable. It's okay that he asks us. It makes sense that we do this. And then Paul goes on in verse 2 and says, and do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. Phillips translation says, don't let the world squeeze you into its mold. Don't let the world squeeze you into its mold. And there's a negative and a positive. The negative is, don't be conformed to this world. Now, and that's where I was going to bring this in, this whole Anna Nicole Smith thing. I mean, we got to look at her and feel sorry for how the world squeezed her into this awful, awful mold. I mean, she was a pretty lady. And the world took advantage of that. You know, now she made decisions, obviously, along the way that were probably not really great. But the world has a tendency to squeeze us into that mold. Think of the commercials that we have. I mean, every commercial tells you, you know, people will think you're better if you drive this kind of car. People will, you know, I don't, these new infomercials that are like on, like for a half hour now on, you know, how to build up, what diet they have. And they all look, you know, everybody is like muscles and no fat. And I mean, you know, and you go, I wouldn't mind looking like that. You know, when I look in the mirror, I'm like, ooh, you know, this is not good. And the world wants to squeeze us into this mold to say, this is the perfect person. This is how the perfect girl looks, just like Anna Nicole. This is what the perfect guy looks like. He's buff and has a six-pack. Look around, you know. And Paul says, it's not real easy sometimes. Commercials are on TV because they work. They get people to buy the nice car. They get people to buy the, you know, there must be people calling in for those diet things and those exercise plans like by the millions, because they wouldn't put it on TV if it didn't work. one time, since he's not here, Joshua and his buddy bought one of those belts that like have electrical pulses, you know. So you don't have to do sit-ups. It sends electric shocks through your, you know, they were like $5, so wasn't too mad or something. You're like, dude, what were you thinking? You know, I mean, it affects all of us. I'm not saying that don't be conformed to this world is easy, that's an easy task, you know, because the world system works. Satan knows how to get to us. And I'm not saying it's easy. And, you know, when you think about the world system and the one version says, the desires of the the eyes and the desires of the flesh and the pride of life. Think of those three things every time you watch a commercial. It involves one of those three things. The pride of life. I'm going to look good. You know, I'm going to... The lust of the eyes. Man, I want that new house. The lust of the flesh. I mean, they know what works, guys. Paul says, don't let the world squeeze you into its mold. And I'm not saying it's easy. But what I am saying is, work at not letting the world squeeze you into what it wants. Think about what God wants for us. And then the positive thing that he says at the end, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. That there's like so many Greek words in this thing that have different translations. That word is the word metamorphosis, where we get, and this one commentary I was reading, he said, you know, nowadays that's talked about a lot, morphing, right? You morph into something. We did, I don't know, if the movie Matrix, you ever seen that movie? I still don't understand it. I mean, it's like bizarre. But there's this one part where that, I guess it's the computer, sticks his hand into the one guy and he morphs into the guy that he stuck his hand into. And I mean, and the world is starting to use this and morphing into something else. And then, what was the other, I think Terminator, where those guys are after him and they morph into something else. It's like a girl one minute and a guy the next, and it's a machine. And it's like, in this commentary I read, said, you know, Christianity had this 2,000 years ago. Morphing into something isn't the world's idea. It's a Christian idea. We have been morphed into something new. You and I have been changed into something new. Don't be transformed, but don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. We need to think different. I know I've given this illustration before, but I think it works. All of you that are going skiing, when you go skiing and you put on skis and boots that are heavy, and you got to learn to renew your mind on how you move. Because if you try to walk in ski boots and skis, it doesn't work. So you got to have an instructor tell you, well, you know, when you're going down the hill, if you want to, your brain is going to tell you if you want to turn right, you lean that way. But if you ski, if you want to turn right, you lean left. And if you want to turn left, you lean right. And if you want to be really good on a steep hill, you lean down the hill. When your brain is telling you, I got to lean up. I mean, if you ever get on a really steep hill, you have to fight that urge to lean downhill. That's what Paul's saying. Just like it, when you ski and you're transformed when you put those skis on, you got to renew your mind on how this is going to work. And Paul is going to say from this chapter on, he's going to give us those instructions on how to make this Christian thing work. In light of what God has already done for us, this is what he wants us to do. And he says, be transformed, be morphed. This is like, and think about how the world is trying to do this. I haven't watched it much, but Extreme Makeover, you know, everybody is, now they do it with houses, they do it with people, and you see some of these people, and it is an extreme makeover. I mean, it changes them, though at least on the outside. It changes them on the outside. What God has done is morphed us from the inside. He's morphed us from the inside. And what Paul is saying is, what's inside, you need to get out. Let the world see what I've done inside of you. And God has done an extreme makeover in you and me. You know, I may look older, but inside, God did, and inside of you, God did an unbelievable morphing. That's one tape I listened to. The guy talked about Steve Jobs, and Steve, you know, everybody knows Steve Jobs, Apple computer, and all that stuff. Well, apparently he went to this, I think his name is Scully. He was the head of Pepsi or Coke, one of the two. And he wanted him to come to Apple. So he comes to him and offers him, you know, unbelievable amounts of money, and Scully turns it down. And he says, just tell me what it would take to bring you over to Apple. And the guy says, I don't want to come. And Steve Jobs looks at him and says, do you want to sell sugar water for the rest of your life? Or change the world? So he came. Apple computer might change the way we work, but they're not going to change the world. What's going to change the world is a group of us being transformed by the renewing of our mind. It's God at work in us that's going to change. I mean, I have trouble changing myself, you know, let alone changing the world. That's a pretty high, you know, that's pretty visions of grandeur for Steve Jobs. But for Christians, that's what we can do because of what God has done. Gary Inrig, in his tapes, one tape I listened to, says there's been a deep change in the core of our character. A major thing happened to you all when we got saved. The other thing that I think we need to think about is that this isn't like a one-time thing. You know, it's, and I guess if you go to a Baptist church, there's like a rededication and a rededication, and, you know. And I kind of understand what they're talking about, because sometimes you feel like you've decided to live this Christian life, and I'm going to really do better now. It really is a lifetime of choices. You know, there, young people, every adult in this room would probably admit that, you know, it ain't easy sometimes. And you're going to make mistakes along the road. And you're going to mess up sometimes really big. That's when you got to go back and think about what God says about you. Because when you mess up, God doesn't go, if I would have known you were going to do that. He loved you while you were yet sinners. While we were yet sinners. It's a continuous work. It's a divine work. Actually, when it says be transformed, it's a passive verb. Do you know what that means? It's not something you do. It's something that's done to you. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what the will of God is. Prove something. It's like, how many of you have ever taken, like, geometry? Don't you have proofs in geometry, right? I used to love geometry. I hate trigonometry. I know I never could figure it out. But you have proofs, right? So you had this problem, and if you figured it out, you did a proof. That's what it's called. You proved how this thing is going to work. That's kind of what Paul is saying here. You do this so you can show that it's true, that you can put something to the test. Try this. It's like Nike's commercial, just do it. Just do this. Give God a chance. Listen to him. When he says, don't be conformed to this world, be transformed by the renewing of your mind, test it. Watch what God will do. Watch what God will do. And then he says, and then you're going to find out what is good, that the will of God for your life is good. And it's acceptable. That's the same word we had earlier. It's pleasing. Now, it's not just pleasing to God. It's pleasing to you and me. The Christian life sometimes ain't easy, but I'm telling you, it is way better. Because I tried the other way. And you don't want to go that way. And it's perfect. Paul ends when he says, in that which is good and acceptable and perfect. We get to live this Christian life. And what from here on, next couple weeks, we're going to go over specifics on what Paul, on how we actually live this life out. And some of it's pretty cool. And if we do it, we'll be pleased. Let me pray. We'll finish. Father, we really want to just take a minute and think about all that you have done for us. Father, I know that sometimes it can get I don't know if we forget or if we don't really appreciate it. But Father, I want us to think back about what you have said in this book of Romans to us. That you've given us you've made us new creations. You've put us under grace and not under the law anymore. You loved us more than we can even ask or think. And Father, now all you do is you urge us, you beg us to live our lives for you. And Father, for the times that this gets difficult for us, we thank you that you still love us and that you still take us just like we are. And yet you will not leave us just like we are. That you want to transform us and let the world see what you can do in the likes of sinful people like us. It's in your Son's name I pray. Amen.
Thank you so much for that message, hymn number 568. And if you would stand with us and sing this. The first verse says, may the mind of Christ my Savior live in me from day to day.